It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with best-selling author and environmental activist Bill McKibben. He was in Iowa yesterday to give the commencement address at Grinnell College. But first, Lucas Mann was only 13 years old when his older brother Josh died of a heroin overdose. Lucas worshipped his brother, but as an adult, he realized that he didn't really know him. He decided to try to find out who his brother really was and has written the new memoir, Lord Fear. Lucas, thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Thanks, Charity.
Now, what was the catalyst for you that made you want to go back and try to figure out who Josh was?
It's been something that kind of ever since I wrote at all, even before I thought of myself as a writer, if I would sit down and try to write, addiction and his life and his presence were always kind of there, lingering in the background. Even in the first book I wrote, Class A, which is about minor league baseball in Iowa, his absence crops up. There's moments where he sort of works his way into the narrative in ways that I didn't plan. So I don't necessarily know if it was ever a conscious thing. It's just the kind of writing that I love and gravitate towards is the essay. And the essay for me is all about these questions, these attempts to answer these questions, and his death was this enormous question that has been there throughout my life, that it kind of seemed unavoidable.
You start the book at your brother's funeral, and I wonder if you could read us just a little bit from
Sure.
that part of the book.
Sure. My surviving brother, Dave, watches Philip, a man he loves very much. Dave lives alone and is often lonely. Philip invites him around for dinner once a week, lets him eat and talk until the loneliness doesn't feel so complete, another small kindness. Dave has sleepy eyes and full lips and a nose with a Semitic bulge that used to give him anxiety when he too wanted to be an actor. Now he teaches six-year-olds at a public school in Harlem and returns home to Gigi, his cat. It's a routine he likes well enough. Today is the first weekday in a long time that the routine has been broken. He will sleep in my room tonight with me, the way he used to with Josh. I will ask him questions that he won't answer. Dave is trying to think of something to say. He looks down at his belly, the belly of a once skinny man whose metabolism slowed before he had time to notice. Josh got fat too, fatter than Dave. All Dave can focus on is how fat his brother got and how, under different circumstances, like both of them being alive, Dave would have teased him for it, and it would have been funny. He wonders how such a huge man in such a huge box will get burned down to fit into a little bag, a light load of laundry. It's like a reverse clown car, a potential joke to open with, but probably not the right one. Dave decides to stay silent. Philip continues his monologue and draws a knowing chuckle from the room. Daniel Chang is impressed by this. Daniel Chang has never performed. He's a perpetual audience member, and he sees no reason to change his role today. Daniel stands in the back near me. He knew me when I was a baby, and once he took a picture that came out nice of me and Josh sitting on a motorcycle. His red tie is making his neck itch, and, looking at Philip's turtleneck, Daniel is a bit angry that he got dressed up for this. Few things are more annoying than dressing formal and then finding out that formality wasn't even required. He stands with Lena and Tommy. They all knew one another pretty well, but Daniel is beginning to see that the spectacle of Lena's grief. He glances at her, then away. He keeps his arms crossed and tries to focus on Philip's stories.
Lucas Mann reading from his memoir, Lord Fear, about his brother, Josh. And you were 13 years old at that funeral. You've painted this very rich picture, not only of what you were feeling when all of this was going on, but the other people in the room as well. Are these all people that you were able to contact and talk to about what they felt, or did you paint the picture partially from your imagination?
Both. The first, there are no chapters, but the first sort of section where you enter into the funeral, for me kind of serves like a scene in a classic play where like all the characters walk out on stage and sort of look at you and nod before the play keeps going. Sort of a way to enter this cast. And the people that I talk about were all people that I was able to talk to about him, and their perspectives sort of bleed into the text. But there is a lot of imagination involved. And before that moment that I read early on, there's a point where I nod to the one thing that I'm sure that I remember, and it's like a distant family member whose last name is Duke, who tells me that if I were her kid, my name would be Luke Duke, and grabs my face. And that's, you know, part of what this book is about, is the way that imagination and memory and storytelling kind of bleed together. And so, yeah, it starts with me saying, this is what I know for sure, and the rest is cobbled together from what I think I know, how I wanted it to have been, and then also the things that other people told me and how I kind of absorbed their stories and went back and created this scene.
Even in that funeral scene, there are these fascinating contradictions between the reality of the situation and between things that are going on in your head. Like, some people tell you that you look like Josh, and you consider this to be a tremendous compliment because you think about your brother Josh as being such a beautiful, beautiful man. And yet, in the section that you just read, your other older brother, Dave, you know, it's ruminating on how fat Josh got. And obviously, by the time he died, I mean, he was just a wreck. So was that something that you were trying to draw into relief, or did that almost come naturally because you had this double reality in your head?
Yeah, I mean, I think both. I think it was something that was consciously a part of the book, but it became more and more a part of the book because that's what the material dictated. And what started out maybe more straightforward with this question of how can I understand Josh a little better? How can I tell his story? It kind of became, in some ways, about the inability to tell that story, or the way that that story doesn't have one story and doesn't really end. And so there's kind of a kaleidoscopic effect in the book. It's, like I said, there's no chapters, so it's just sort of moving through fragments of the way that different people saw him, often contradicting one another right on top of that. And then me kind of pushing through the middle, sometimes not getting anything that anybody was telling me, or not necessarily agreeing with that. And that to me became maybe certainly the most interesting and maybe the most accurate portrayal of the way we remember, and particularly the way that we deal with something like addiction, the different narratives, whether they're sort of the before shot and the after shot, or the redemption story, or the explanation, right? We sort of, everybody crafts these different narratives out of this very small sample size of moments that they actually had with the person.
When Josh died, he thought of himself as a writer. He was not a published writer, not since he was a teenager. But your father and Josh's mother, Josh was your half-brother, and Dave is also your half-brother. Your father and his former wife, they gave you all of Josh's writing, which seems really almost shocking that, you know, here is this man who has battled addiction for a very long time, or succumbed to addiction for a very long time, and has this giant pile of papers, and they hand it to a 13-year-old boy.
Oh, no, yeah, that, I mean, that would have been insane.
Okay,
That moment never happened. No, there was, like, so his writing was collected and put in the suitcase, and then it just sort of stayed at our place, and I was the person that was sort of curious, and then over the years more and more wanted to see it. And then as I got older and as I was thinking about writing this, it was sort of given over to me. But yeah, I do think it sort of came with his CDs, his writing, all of these things kind of de facto came to me because they were these fragments of him that I hadn't really gotten to live in the way that other people had, that I was still, there was as much curiosity as there was pain for me. And I think for a lot of other people, that wasn't the case.
You also had other artifacts of Josh, his leather jacket, for example. And it strikes me, you know, in a lot of ways, Josh's death is such an incredible cautionary tale, all of this wasted potential. But were you almost encouraged to sort of continue that hero worship even after his death?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I don't know how much it was encouraged or allowed. Right. You know, I had, I think, the least complex, and I had the least complex feelings about it. Right. I didn't know as much. And I sort of saw him, with this kind of hero worship that I knew him as a kid. Right. I mean, I was talking about it in an interview the other day and kind of realized that I didn't have a bar mitzvah when I was 13, but that sort of turning point of you're a man now, in a weird way, his funeral sort of served as that. So there was still a lot of shine on what I remembered. And I think it probably was comforting, or at least easier for a lot of people to let me live with that shine until I started pushing.
And you have a scene in the book when you and the family, you return to Josh's grave every year on his birthday. Mm-hmm. And that's become a family ritual. And standing around the grave, I think your father says at first, you know, he didn't deserve this. He didn't deserve this. And that seems to be the family mantra. Although Josh made very clear decisions mm-hmm. that led him down that path.
Yeah. And I mean, that a lot of the sort of narrative moving forward turns on that line because there's something so sincere but also futile about that sensibility. And it's really the only thing that you can say for sure about somebody that died like this is nobody deserves that. And then there's everything else under that, right? There's the series of choices that people make. There's the sort of pain for them and the pain for others and all of these things. But I think that a lot of the narrative about his life, and I think for a lot of people who have dealt with that loss, is, right, you can be sure of the fact that a person didn't deserve this. And you can't really argue with that. But then there's so much complexity underneath it. And at a certain point for me, I think it became kind of impossible to not say, well, okay, yes, but I want to know more.
And we're going to have to take a short break, but in turning to people to find out about Josh, I mean, you had talked about Josh with your family members for so long, for so many years. Had a point come where no one remembered what he was really like in your family?
I don't know. I think that might be sort of an ever-evolving thing. I think that people continue to remember how he was for them. And then they're also remembering how he feels for them in that moment. A lot of the book is about the weird ways that memory works. And I think if I had these conversations now, they would be entirely different conversations with a lot of the people. And that doesn't invalidate what they were saying then, but people exist in memory only in that moment that you're remembering them.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Lucas Mann. His latest book is a memoir. It's called Lord Fear. It's written about his brother, Josh, who died of a heroin overdose in the year 2000. We'll talk more in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in just a few minutes, I'll talk with environmental activist and best-selling author Bill McKibben. He gave the commencement address at Grinnell College yesterday. We'll talk about trying to get people engaged in the fight against climate change. But right now, my guest is Lucas Mann. He's the author of a new memoir. It's called Lord Fear. And it's a book he wrote about his big brother, Josh, who died when Lucas was only 13 years old of a heroin overdose. And I mentioned that you ended up with this archive of all of Josh's writing, so you could go back into that and hear his voice that way. But you also started trying to reconnect with a lot of people that Josh had been close to in real life, or at least had interacted with in real life, and not just family members. And one of the people that you turned to was Philip, mm-hmm. the man who presided over Josh's funeral. And in many ways, this was, in your eyes, as a 13-year-old, I mean, this was a very close friend of Josh's. This was a man who had realized the potential that you saw in Josh in many ways. And when you went to Phil to ask him about Josh, you heard things you were not expecting to hear. I mean, what were your expectations going into those conversations?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in general, every conversation in the book and then every scene that's written from these different people's kind of perspectives, it's all weighted with the expectation that I brought in. And I kind of just like that in general in books when the dramatic tension is just sort of in a conversation, right? People have what they want to take out of it, and then you have to sort of bump up against what somebody wants to give you. And that was the first interview that I did with Phil. And so, yeah, I sort of went in, I think, expecting confirmation, right? Maybe saying that what I wanted was an interview and what I wanted was answers. But then having to kind of interrogate what, in fact, I really wanted and how I was going to react to somebody saying, these are a lot of difficult things that I remember. I don't remember in the way that you want me to. And then that kind of ultimately propels the narrative forward into that tension sort of being everywhere, right? What do I want out of these people? And what do they want out of this conversation with me? And then what each of us wants out of Josh's legacy.
The picture that Phil painted of your brother Josh was a young man. I mean, I guess you would almost call him narcissistic, very, very self-involved, lacking in empathy for others. There's a scene that you put in the book where Phil describes Josh torturing his cat. And you also, I mean, there are lots of other scenes after this in the book when you went to other people where Josh was a bully. Mm-hmm. He hurt people and he didn't seem to care. And it's really easy to sort of armchair psychiatrist this now. And I mean, and Josh was in therapy when he was in school because of behavior problems in school. Were there mental health diagnoses that you know about?
It comes up in the book. You know, when he was a kid, a lot of this was operating sort of without diagnoses being present. One of the more compelling things that I was told about was this idea of depersonalization that kind of was, I think, the word that he was given to sort of stand in for these extreme panic attacks and this, you know, really sort of painful anxiety and sort of feeling like he was losing himself. And that in his own writing and reading his own writing, the sort of pain and the difficulty of feeling that way and not necessarily knowing how to deal with it in the way that anybody does. There was a lot of vulnerability in the way that he thought about himself and tried to think about the way he acted and tried to make himself feel better that ran so counter to what I think people saw on the outside, right? The manifestation of acting on that pain and in some cases causing pain for others.
Phil, you expected him to be someone who loved Josh very much. I mean, that's how you saw him when you were growing up. And of course, again, he was there at the funeral and he was helping others through their grief over Josh's death. And then the reality you found was that Phil was kind of the positive older influence that your parents and Josh's parents really, really wanted him to have. I mean, your dad and his ex-wife really worked hard to keep Phil in Josh's life, just hoping it would kind of rub off.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was a sort of a stark change in the narrative in my head to bump up against it. And then, you know, it led to sort of more complex thought processes of, right, I think there's originally sort of anger of why are you not saying things that I want you to say? But then, you know, in the way that any people deal with each other or particularly remember each other, right, whatever the motivations were, whatever lingers, then Phil and everybody else in the book, right, was there and did have this relationship and is still trying to sort of make meaning out of that relationship. And there's so much more nuance to it that I think the book sort of tries to ultimately get at than simply he was great, I loved him, or actually he was a bad guy and I didn't like him.
The flip side, and you do a beautiful job sort of going back and forth between these different ideas of your brother, Josh. But the flip side is this incredibly charismatic, funny guy that girls wanted to be with and boys wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And you talked to his friend Daniel, who also made a small appearance in the funeral scene that you read from earlier. But I mean, Daniel was as enamored with Josh as you were.
Yeah. I mean, not only was there that, but it was also the different people that I talked to each had their sort of window of knowing him, right? So the way that somebody sees Josh at 14 when Daniel was also 14, that's such a different relationship than somebody seeing Josh when Josh was 12 and that person was 40. And so it was kind of these different, this sort of kaleidoscopic effect, these different shifting perspectives. And Daniel's moment was this sort of pure teenage id, right, of looking at the cool kid. And in the narrative, that kind of, that very consciously for me comes right after the Phil section, to hopefully give that sense of even when you feel like you're going in one section, certainly, right? Actually, these were his problems. These were the things that he was dealing with. You can shift so easily into somebody who only remembers this sort of shining Adonis figure, and that both of those are not wrong.
Your brother, when he was in high school, he got very into bodybuilding and being healthy. And I mean, a lot of the destructive behaviors that came later, he was very dismissive of people who demonstrated those behaviors earlier. But I found it very interesting because it seems to me that it's a different expression of his addictive personality that he went full bore in whatever direction he was going in.
Yeah, there's that level of intensity, right? Which is, I think, kind of what you were getting at, too. What the people, when people remember him with anger, when people remember him with sort of admiration or joy, it's intense in either direction. And that's what it was for me, right? That was particularly for me as a kid. That was the sensibility of this, the full bore in any direction, right? If he was going to make a joke, he was going to make a big, potentially offensive joke. Or, you know, if he was going to be in shape, he was going to be in great shape. Or if he was going to hurt himself, there was kind of no way that it wouldn't be bad. And that intensity and sort of the different places that it pulled him is kind of all over the book, because that's what he left behind.
I'm talking with Lucas Mann. His book is Lord Fear. It's a memoir of his life with his brother Josh, who died in 2000. And I want you to tell me a little bit about this is Josh's brother, or Josh's cousin Caleb. So I'm not sure how the two of you are related, because again, Josh is your half brother. But Caleb was 7 years old, and you write about this memory that he has of an interaction with Josh, which from the outside is just truly horrific. I mean, Josh leads this, and you know, there were other boys involved, but he leads this sort of bullying assault on Caleb, where they wind up stripping Caleb naked and duct taping him to a chair and dragging the chair into an elevator in the apartment building. Josh presses all of the buttons in the elevator so that it's going to open on every floor, with Caleb sitting there naked, strapped to this chair.
Right.
And Caleb's memory of this somehow ended up being, you know, mostly positive. Mm-hmm. Josh is hilarious. Josh was wonderful. Josh was great to be around. It's so fascinating to to try to reconcile that. And, I, you know, it's a further example of a 7-year-old or a 13-year-old or a child's memory of someone. But when you were talking to Caleb about Josh, I mean, again, what did you come away with?
It was almost sort of the opposite frustration of talking to Philip. And again, right, it was any sort of conflict that's in these representations, I think, came from me, you know, from sort of having to interrogate over and over again my search and what I wanted out of it, right? And you want somebody to remember in more complex ways. You want somebody to remember in more positive ways. And so the tension in talking to Caleb in recording his scene was about sort of his open unwillingness to go to dark places, right? And just sort of being absolutely out front about it, and just being like, look, he was a lion to me. He was a god to me. I have these memories. These mean a lot to me. Why do I want to talk about any of the other stuff? And then kind of me having to be like, God, I guess, yeah, why? You know, that we each sort of have our different motivations, and constantly having to sort of question, what do I want at this? Why poke at something? Why not leave well enough alone and sort of let the shine, the sort of childhood shine, stay there?
In Josh's absence, it almost seems like he was a bigger force in your life than he would have been had he lived.
I think that is I don't know. All I do know is how much of a force the absence has been, and it has been an enormous one. And there's a moment in the book when I'm talking about those of us, you know, who survive him, and I think I say his life and his deaths kind of became the axis on which all other stories turn, and that's one of the things that has always brought me back to this, and that I think is so enormously fascinating about addiction like this and addiction narratives is that when something like this happens, when it weights everything that comes afterward. How can everything not relate to the sort of unerasable and confusing awfulness of the way this life ended?
Well, and as large as Josh loomed for you, you also write a lot about your other half-brother, Dave. Your relationship with Dave got a lot stronger after Josh's death. And Dave had always been in Josh's shadow. He was the nice kid, the good kid, and by comparison, I think the unremarkable.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's how he felt. And Josh's death seemed to just affect Dave so much as well, and for many, many years.
Yeah. Again, talking about how the book sort of evolved away from the question at the heart of it, right, is who was this guy? How to know Josh better? But then I think it also, that search becomes as much about the people around him, right? And again, his absence, to me, I feel like I know him better, or we maybe come to understand him better through getting to know Dave and just how enormously weighted his life has been by this shadow and by this tragedy. And again, it's all of these lives and all of these stories moving around this axis that can't be changed.
I mentioned earlier that in so many ways, Josh's life was this cautionary tale. It's the kind of thing that you tell kids, you know, don't get involved in drugs because this could be you.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, in spite of how horribly things ended for Josh, his behavior actually, in a way, it pulled Dave toward drug use. It actually pulled you toward drug use. This idea of, well, if it was so amazing that Josh died for it, what was it? I want to know what was there.
Right. Yeah. And that's another thing, too, is that's a complexity that I think is not often talked about with addiction narratives, right? Or about drugs in general, right? Either you experiment and it's cool and dangerous, or it's this cautionary tale. And I think for me, growing up in the wake of this, a lot of my relationship to it has sort of been negotiating danger and the appeal of danger and the appeal of intense sensation and doing the transgressive thing. And almost feeling bad about my own fear of those things, and then sort of pushing on that a little more. And yeah, I think there's always going to be a lot more going on than the easier story to tell, which is I saw this cautionary tale, and the legacy of that was that it kept me on the straight and narrow.
Right. Well, and I mean, the very terrifying, you write about your brother Dave's suicide attempt, and in some ways, it seems like Josh's death made it much easier for Dave to think about dying, for him to almost die.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I don't know what he was feeling. But I know for me in that moment, it was sort of feeling how hard it is to live and live well and be good to yourself, and how enormous a legacy of how difficult that is, right? And again, I think addiction narratives I think in the book I say, pretend that there's one hole that one person fell into, and then either they climb out of it or the hole sort of closes behind them, and it's tragic, but it's neat and it's tidy.
Right.
And there's a lot of mess that comes with any life, and particularly what a life like Josh's leaves behind.
You have rebuilt your brother in some ways. You have revisited so many people who knew him, who had relationships with him. You have experienced the positive, magnetic, brilliant side of Josh, the ugly side of Josh. In the end, how does that change you?
I don't know. I don't necessarily think of personal writing or memoir writing as a sort of cathartic experience, although maybe it is. I don't know how it's changed me. In a weird way, you know, when you write about someone and you try to reconstruct someone, that becomes the story for you. So it's almost like I sort of gave myself a different legacy to work with, and the process of attempted reconstruction has kind of become the memory. And I don't necessarily know if that's a positive thing or a negative thing, but it's definitely a still evolving thing.
Lucas, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lucas Mann, his most recent book is Lord Fear. It's a memoir about his brother, Josh. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with environmental activist and best-selling author Bill McKibben about what it's going to take for humanity to wake up to the threat of climate change. That's coming up in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.